Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. In the year 1872, the house, number 7 Savile Row, Burlington Gardens, the house in which Sheridan died in 1814, was inhabited by Phileas Fogg, Esquire, one of the most singular and most noticed members of the Reform Club of London, although he seemed to take care to do nothing which might attract attention. This Phileas Fogg, then, an enigmatic personage of whom nothing was known but that he was a very polite man and one of the most perfect gentlemen of good English society, succeeded one of the great orators that honour England. An Englishman Phileas Fogg was, surely, but perhaps not a Londoner. This gentleman did not figure in any public body. His name had never sounded in any Inns of Court, nor in the Temple, nor Lincoln's Inn, nor Gray's Inn. He never pleaded in the Court of Chancery, nor the Queen's Bench, nor the Exchequer, nor the Ecclesiastical Courts. He was not a member of the Royal Institution of Great Britain, or the London Institution, or the Artisans Association, or the Russell Institution, or the Literary Institution of the West, or the Law Institute, or that Institute of the Arts and Sciences placed under the direct patronage of Her Gracious Majesty. In fact, he belonged to none of the numerous societies that swarm in the capital of England, from the Harmonic to the Entomological Society, founded principally for the purpose of destroying hurtful insects. Phileas Fogg was a member of the Reform Club, and that was all. Was this Phileas Fogg rich? Undoubtedly. But the best informed could not say how he had made his money. He was by no means extravagant in anything, neither was he avaricious, for when money was needed for a noble purpose, he gave it quietly, and even anonymously. He talked as little as possible, and seemed much more mysterious than silent. His life was open to the light, but what he did was always so mathematically the same thing that the imagination, unsatisfied, sought further. Had he travelled? It was probable, for none knew the world better than he. There was no spot so secluded that he did not appear to have a special acquaintance with it. One thing was certain, however, that for many years Phileas Fogg had not been from London. Those who had the honour of knowing him more intimately than others affirmed that no one could pretend to have seen him elsewhere than upon the direct route which he traversed every day to go from his house to the club. Phileas Fogg was not known to have either wife or children. Phileas Fogg lived alone in his house in Savile Row, where nobody entered. There was never a question as to its interior. A single servant sufficed to serve him. Breakfasting and dining at the club, at hours fixed with the utmost exactness, he returned home only to go to bed exactly at midnight. This very day, the 2nd of October, Phileas Fogg had dismissed James Forster, this youth having incurred his displeasure by bringing him shaving water at 84 degrees Fahrenheit instead of 86, and he was waiting for his successor. At this moment, there was a knock at the door of the small parlour in which was Phileas Fogg. James Forster, the dismissed servant, appeared.
"The new servant," said he.
A young man, aged 30 years, came forward and bowed.
"You are a Frenchman, and your name is John?" Phileas Fogg asked the new man.
"Jean, if it does not displease monsieur," replied the newcomer. "Jean Passepartout, a surname which has clung to me and which my natural aptitude for withdrawing from a business has justified. I've had several trades. I've been a travelling singer, a circus rider, then I became a professor of gymnastics, and in the last place I was a sergeant fireman at Paris. But 5 years have passed since I left France, and wishing to have a taste of family life, I have been a valet in England. Now, finding myself out of a situation, and having learned that Monsieur Phileas Fogg was the most exact and the most settled gentleman in the United Kingdom, I have presented myself to Monsieur with the hope of living tranquilly with him."
"You are recommended to me," replied the gentleman. "I have good reports concerning you. You know my conditions?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
"Well, what time have you?"
11:22,
replied Passepartout, drawing from the depths of his pocket an enormous silver watch.
"You are slow," said Mr. Fogg.
Pardon me, monsieur, but it is impossible."
"You are 4 minutes too slow. It does not matter. It suffices to state the difference. Then, from this moment, 29 minutes after 11 o'clock a.m., this Wednesday, October the 2nd, 1872, you are in my service. That said, Phileas Fogg rose, took his hat in his left hand, placed it upon his head with an automatic movement, and disappeared without another word.
"Upon my word," said Passepartout to himself, "I have known at Madame Tussaud good people as lively as my new master."
During the few minutes that he had interviewed Phileas Fogg, Passepartout had examined his future master rapidly but carefully. He was a man that might be 40 years old, of fine, handsome face, of tall figure, which a slight corpulence did not disparage, his hair and whiskers light, his forehead compact, without appearance of wrinkles at the temples, his face rather pale than flushed, his teeth magnificent. Indeed, Phileas Fogg was exactness personified. As for Jean, called Passepartout, he was a good fellow, of amiable physiognomy, his lips a little prominent, a mild, a serviceable being, with one of those good round heads that we like to see on the shoulders of a friend. After having had, as we have seen, quite a wandering youth, he longed for repose. A person such as Mr. Phileas Fogg, whose existence was so regular, who never slept in a strange bed, who did not travel, who was never absent, not even for a day, could not but suit him. At 11:30, Passepartout found himself alone in the Savile Row mansion. This clean, well-ordered, austere, Puritan house pleased him. On the mantel, an electric clock corresponded with the one in Phileas Fogg's bedchamber, both beating the same second at the same instant.
"That suits me. That suits me," said Passepartout.
He observed also in the room a notice fastened above the clock. It was the programme for the daily service. Passepartout took a pleasure in contemplating this programme and impressing upon his mind its various directions. As to the gentleman's wardrobe, it was in very good taste and wonderfully complete. In short, in this house in Savile Row, its comfortable furniture indicated a delightful ease. Everything there denoted the most peaceful habits. Phileas Fogg had left his house in Savile Row at 11:30, and after putting his right foot before his left foot 575 times, and his left foot before his right foot 576 times, he arrived at the Reform Club, a spacious and lofty building in Pall Mall. The gentleman repaired immediately to the dining room, whose 9 windows opened upon a fine garden with trees already gilded by autumn. There he took his seat at his regular table, where the plate was awaiting him. At 47 minutes past noon, this gentleman rose and turned his steps towards the large hall. There, a servant handed him The Times, uncut, the tiresome cutting of which he managed with a steadiness of hand which denoted great practice. The reading of this journal occupied Phileas Fogg until 4:15, and that of The Standard, which succeeded it, lasted until dinner. At 6:20, the gentleman reappeared in the large hall and was absorbed in the reading of The Morning Chronicle. 30 minutes later, various members of the Reform Club entered and came near the fireplace in which a coal fire was burning. They were the usual partners of Phileas Fogg, like himself, passionate players of whist. The engineer, Andrew Stewart, the bankers, John Sullivan and Samuel Fallentin, the brewer, Thomas Flanagan, Gautier Ralph, one of the directors of the Bank of England, rich and respected personages, the elite of trade and finance.
"Well, Ralph," asked Thomas Flanagan, "how about that robbery?"
"Why," said Andrew Stewart, "the bank will lose the money."
"I hope, on the contrary," said Gautier Ralph, "that we will put our hands on the robber. Detectives, very skilful fellows, have been sent to America and the continent, and it'll be difficult for this fellow to escape."
"But you have the description of the robber?" asked Andrew Stewart.
"Well, in the first place, he's not a robber," replied Gautier Ralph seriously.
"Is he, then, a manufacturer?" said John Sullivan.
"The Morning Chronicle assures us that he is a gentleman."
The party that made this reply was no other than Phileas Fogg, whose head then emerged from the mass of papers heaped around him. The matter under discussion, and which the various journals of the United Kingdom were discussing ardently, had occurred 3 days before, on the 29th of September. A package of banknotes, making the enormous sum of £55,000, had been taken from the counter of the principal cashier of the Bank of England.
The robbery being duly known, agents, detectives, selected from the most skillful, were sent to the principal ports, Liverpool, Glasgow, Havre, Suez, Brindisi, New York, etc., with the promise, in case of success, of a reward of £2,000 and 5% of the amount recovered. There was good reason for supposing that the robber was not a member of any of the robber bands of England. During this day, the 29th of September, a well-dressed gentleman of good manners, of a distinguished air, had been noticed going in and out of the paying room, the scene of the robbery. The investigation allowed a pretty accurate description of the gentleman to be made out, which was at once sent to all the detectives of the United Kingdom and of the continent. "I maintain," said Andrew Stewart, "that the chances are in favour of the robber, who must be a skilful fellow."
"Well," replied Ralph, "there's not a single country where you can take refuge."
"Tchah!
Where do you suppose you might go?"
"I don't know about that," replied Andrew Stewart, "but after all, the world is big enough."
"It was formerly," said Phileas Fogg in a low tone. Then he added, "It is your turn to cut, sir," presenting the cards to Thomas Flanagan.
The discussion was suspended during the rubber, but Andrew Stewart soon resumed it, saying, "How formerly? Has the world grown smaller, perchance?"
"Without doubt," replied Gautier Ralph. "I am of the opinion of Mr. Fogg. The world has grown smaller, since we can go round it now 10 times quicker than 100 years ago."
"It is your turn to play, Mr. Stewart," said Phileas Fogg. But the incredulous Stewart was not convinced, and when the hand was finished, he replied, "It must be confessed, Mr. Ralph, that you have found a funny way of saying that the world has grown smaller, because the tour of it is now made in 3 months."
"In 80 days only," said Phileas Fogg.
"Yes, gentlemen," added John Sullivan, "this is true. Here is the calculation made by the Morning Chronicle. From London to Suez via Mont-Cenis and Brindisi by rail and steamers, 7 days. From Suez to Bombay, steamer, 13 days. From Bombay to Calcutta, rail, 3 days. From Calcutta to Hong Kong, China, steamer, 13 days. From Hong Kong to Yokohama, Japan, steamer, 6 days. From Yokohama to San Francisco, steamer, 22 days. From San Francisco to New York, rail, 7 days. From New York to London, steamer and rail, 9 days. Total, 80 days.
"Yes, 80 days, exclaimed Andrew Stewart, who by inattention made a wrong deal. "But not including bad weather, contrary winds, shipwrecks, running off the track, etc.?"
"Everything included," replied Phileas Fogg, continuing to play, for this time the discussion no longer respected the game. Andrew Stewart, whose turn it was to deal, gathered up the card, saying,
"Theoretically you're right, Mr. Fogg, but practically..."
"Practically also, Mr. Stewart."
"Well, make it then."
"The tour of the world in 80 days?
"Yes."
"I am willing."
"When?"
"At once. Only I warn you that I shall do it at your expense."
"It is folly,"
cried Stewart, who was beginning to be vexed at the persistence of his partner.
"Stop! Let us play, rather."
"Deal again, then," replied Phileas Fogg, "for there is a false deal." Andrew Stewart took up the cards again with a feverish hand. Then, suddenly placing them upon the table, he said,
"Well, Mr. Fogg, do it. And I bet £4,000.
"My dear Stewart," said Fallentin, "compose yourself. It's not serious."
"When I say I bet," replied Andrew Stewart, "it is always serious."
"So be it," said Mr. Fogg, and then, turning to his companions, continued, "I have £20,000 deposited at Baring Brothers. I will willingly risk them."
£20,000?
Cried John Sullivan.
£20,000, which an unforeseen delay may make you lose."
"The unforeseen does not exist," replied Phileas Fogg quietly.